Today is Monday. It's June 9th, 2025. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Don Christensen. Don spells his last name C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Don. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Great. Don, thank you so much for your willingness to do these oral histories. May we have your permission to record this part 4 over the telephone?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. We left off in the mid-1980s with the Western Archaeological Conservation Center. Can you pick that up for me?
Okay. I worked portions of 11 years summers in petrified forest.
Okay.
For the Western Archaeological Conservation Center. The person that got that moving was a couple from California, Jack and Pat McCreary. That's M-C-C-R-E-E-R-Y. And they got interested. I'm not quite sure how they got interested in it, but anyway. Jack was a retired colonel from the Air Force that flew in World War II and the Korean War. And Pat, I don't know what she did. Well, they had met in World War II when Jack was in training to become a pilot.
Oh, wow.
And he ran out of fuel or something, and he lit down. He had to land in without crashing. He had to land in some little dinky hound town in the Central Valley.
Okay.
And that's where he met Pat.
Oh, my gosh. How cool is that?
And Pat, and they had a romance and got married and were married for a good long time. Pat's parents owned an oil well.
Okay.
So money was never a problem for them, for their out.
Owned one oil well.
At least one. I'm not sure how many.
They owned oil wells.
Anyway, the McCreary's financed the work that we did in Petrified Forest.
Okay.
So they covered all the expenses for the Park Service and for WAC. And eventually, some of us even got a salary. I eventually actually was employed by the Park Service.
Oh, wow.
And eventually reached the lofty position of a stage 7, whatever that is, a WS 7.
A GS 7?
That's not important.
Okay.
Really.
No, that was
anyway,
good.
They... brought with them some friends from Minnesota, Kitty and Jim Stoddard, S-T-O-D-D-A-R-D. Jim Stoddard was associated with the university there, and he had been coming to the Southwest every year because he was the guy that taught the astronomy students how to use the big telescopes.
Okay.
And so they came to the Tucson area, and because there's a big observatory up on top of Mount Lemmon.
Or is it Kid
Peak? Jim was the guy that showed the kids how to use all the equipment and all that stuff.
Don, would that have been Kid Peak?
I'm sorry, what?
Well, there's
no, it wasn't Kit. It wasn't Kit Peak.
Okay.
I know that.
Okay.
That's a sacred peak for the local Indians.
Okay.
Anyway, so they came, and pretty soon there was a group of people that they came almost, they worked almost every year for the 11 years.
Okay.
That included a guy named Bob Cooper. Bob was an engineer that worked for NASA, and he is the guy that designed the ceramic tiles that went on the front of the space capsule.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so he was an absolute nervous wreck when they first made the flight because he wasn't sure that the capsules would handle the heat and stay glued to the front of the thing and all that stuff. So,
yeah.
And Bob was the nicest guy in the world. I mean, he was really a nice guy. We got Frank and AJ Bach, who I had worked with on several projects in Snake Gulch, and several places here in the Southwest. They came in and worked for us for numerous years, and then we had a local guy named Farrell Knight, and Farrell worked for the Park Service, but he lived in that little small Mormon community south of Petrified Forest,
Holbrook.
Would
that be Holbrook?
Holbrook. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, it was Holbrook. He lived in Holbrook. So Farrell was on the team, and he would come out and work with us. And he was a great guy. He was, and he knew a lot of the sites in the immediate area. There are some incredible rock art sites around Holbrook.
Okay.
Down the little Colorado River, Silver Creek, and all those places. And then we had volunteers from all over the place. We had people from the park that volunteered. We had acquaintances of acquaintances. We had husbands that came in, worked with wives, and it was really, really a good deal. All right, so.
Hang on a second, Don. I got a ton of questions now.
Okay.
So, the Western Archaeological Conservation Center. Can you first of all tell me a little bit about that, and then I'll want to know how Jack and Pat got involved with the WAC, and so kind of open that up a little bit.
Okay, WAC is a part of the National Park Service. There are actually several several locations for WAC. I think there's one in the Midwest in Nebraska or somewhere.
Okay.
They have an office and a facility in Tucson. They curate collections.
Right.
And so one of the things that was really interesting for me on one occasion is I got a chance to go through the curation collections, and it's just obviously they're not afraid of earthquakes in Tucson.
No.
Because they have all these shelving all over the place that are just filled and shelf after shelf after shelf with complete archaeological or complete Pueblo pottery,
right,
that they have collected in various places. And then they have tapestries, they have basketry, they have all that what we call perishable stuff under climatic conditions, heat and humidity and all that stuff to help preserve it. So it's an amazing place. For a couple of years, I don't know why, I had to go through Tucson before I went to Petrified Forest so they could pay me for my work. And
wow.
I don't know why that was, but, so I got a chance to see the collections, which was neat.
Yeah.
And so that was a good deal. Okay. Jack and Pat somehow wandered in to Petrified Forest and went and talked to the superintendent.
Okay.
Who was a guy named Ed Gastelum. And I don't know how to spell Gastelum, but, do the best you can on that one.
Yeah, we'll look it up.
Anyway, they offered Ed Gastelum was telling them, well, there's a lot of work here to be done, but we can't get anybody to do it. And they said, well, what if the McCreary said, well, what if we get you volunteers? And he'd go, that's perfect. Yeah, that would be great. So they did. So there was a newsletter that the Western Rock Art, the rock art people put out, and they put a notice in there, and they said, look, we're looking for volunteers who want to work in Petrified Forest in Arizona. And I had worked a lot in California, and California archaeology is not something that will get your heart pumping.
Okay.
It's lots and lots of seashells. You spend a lot of time looking at chione and scallop shells and burnt rock and ground stone fragments. So I'm thinking to myself, go ahead.
Don, what was the volunteer work they were asking for? Was this, what were they asking?
They didn't say. They said, well, we're looking for volunteers to help with survey. They did say survey.
Okay.
That was the work.
Thank you.
And I had done survey work here in California. So anyway, so they asked for volunteers, and they got some. Not a whole bunch, but they got some.
Well, they got you.
They got me. But, the problem was is that they were asking for volunteers to work in the summertime.
Oh.
Well, that's monsoon season, but that's the hot part of the year.
Yeah.
So there were days when we worked in 95 degrees. A couple of days it hit 100, but, it was usually in the 90s. And so what we would do, we would start in the morning with full canteens. And I could only carry like 2 quarts, 3 quarts. And then we'd come back at lunchtime to the vehicles and refill and go back out and work in the afternoon.
Got it.
And we would start work at 6:30 in the morning because okay. In the afternoon, that's when the monsoons roll in.
Okay.
And life gets rather interesting out there.
with lightning, I bet. And yes, indeed. Gumbo.
In fact, a guy that wound up being the first person that we had as our field director was a gal named Ann Trinkle Jones.
Okay.
And she was an archaeologist with the Park Service. And she was great. She was from Virginia. She had a very different Southern accent than I was used to, but she was really good. She was a good person to work with. She was very patient. And then we had after her Sue Wells, and then eventually, God, this is why I have notes. Where are my notes? It'll come to me. I'll get
no,
caught up.
No worries. Yeah. There's just a lot of different things going on here for a minute. So Jack and Pat went to Superintendent Costello, Costello was saying, we have a large monument, isn't it? Is Petrified Forest a national monument?
No, it's a national park.
It's a park. Okay, we have a large park here, and we have no archaeological survey of the resources we have in the park.
It's been very limited.
Okay, and so.
So what they proposed to do,
right,
was to do a survey around the perimeter of the park.
Okay.
That's 92 miles.
Wow. Okay. Just the perimeter.
So, yeah, just the perimeter. But the way you do survey is that we worked usually in teams of 5 people. Sometimes we could run 2 teams, sometimes 3 teams if we had enough bodies.
Okay.
And you spread out about 25 meters apart, and you walk straight line transects. So we had a natural right boundary, which was the boundary fence of the park.
Okay.
And so we could do a swath about 100 meters wide, and we'd walk that for a mile, and then we'd turn back and come back another mile down the other side. So what we did is one of us would walk on the perimeter, the outside of the group, and you'd leave flagging tape every so often.
Ah, okay.
So you could find your way back.
Got it.
So then when you got to the end of the mile, you'd turn around and one guy would pick up all the flagging tape and another guy would lay out the flagging tape on the other edge.
So let me make sure I understand this correctly. You're basically, you have enough people to walk 100 meter wide, that's roughly 300 feet sort of distance, and you're on the inside of the fence.
Yes, just
and,
inside. The fence was our right line, yeah.
Right, and somebody's putting down red
flagging tape.
Red flagging tape, basically 100 meters away from the fence. And then you would turn around and come back. So basically you would survey 200 meters from the fence line into the park.
No, eventually we're going to walk four transects and we'll do a 400 meters.
Okay. So,
you could do 100 meters up and 100 meters down. But you walk that eight times.
But you weren't on the outside of the fence. You were always on the inside of the fence.
Always on the inside.
Okay, so you're doing an ever wider area.
So when we get done, we've done a 400 meter swath through the park.
So out and back.
Inside the boundary fence.
Out and back and out and back.
Yeah.
Okay.
We could usually survey about 1 mile a day.
Okay.
So this is going to take us a number of summers to do. Okay. And that's why I was there for 11 years.
So can you tell me what would eat up the time? Because if you asked me to walk a mile, turn around and walk a mile back, turn around and walk a mile back again, and then turn around and walk a mile back, I got to walk 4 miles. I can do that in 2.5 hours.
But we are recording what we find as we go.
Okay. How did you record what you found, and what sort of things did you find?
Okay. So we would find lithic scatters where somebody had been working petrified wood into sharp objects,
okay,
projectile points, knives, scrapers, that kind of stuff. And the thing that people probably don't realize, the petrified logs in the park, and there are some that are amiss, are actually like prehistoric quarries.
Okay.
Because the Native Americans way back, they found out that had what we call a conchoidal fracture.
Yep.
Which means it breaks like glass. So they'd whack that stuff and they could make, objects that eventually could be made out of that. Usually they would just knock off a piece and reduce it in size to what we call a preform, and then they could take that back to somewhere else and finish working it out.
So the petrified wood, it wasn't like wood at all anymore. It had turned into like almost chert. Is that right? What would be the?
It's probably, if you're going to get into geological terms, it's probably like chalcedony.
Okay.
Or even like agate.
Agate.
Same
okay.
thing.
Yeah. Great.
But it's the conchoidal fracture, which is the big deal.
It's a really nicely workable stone for lithics.
And we eventually in time found, because the petrified forest, the petrified wood in that forest, that the material and is gorgeous. It comes in a variety of colors.
Right.
And one of the guys I worked with, Marty Tagg, T-A-G-G, was a good flint napper. So because we had Saturday and Sunday off, so one Sunday afternoon, we took a six-pack of beer and we went down to an area which they called the junk pile, where they had stuff that the park couldn't use anymore, and they just had deposited out there while I tried to figure out how to get rid of it.
Right.
And we went down. See, the public is not allowed to camp in the park.
Okay.
So it's day use only. And as you come into the park, there's a sign that says your car is subject to search upon leaving because it is illegal to remove petrified wood from the park.
Okay.
And when they come out, there's another sign that says, be prepared for your car to be searched. And all of a sudden people go, oh, my God, I forgot about that. And they've got petrified wood in their pockets and they're sitting there. And so they start tossing it out the window.
Okay.
Sometimes they even remember to roll the window down before they start tossing it.
Oh, good.
So, like, the last 400 meters before you exit the park is just littered with petrified wood that's been thrown out the windows and a fair amount of broken glass from broken windshields.
Oh, my gosh.
Broken windows on the cars.
Huh.
It was pretty funny. So, anyway, Marty and I went down to where they collected all the stuff that's been thrown by the roadside, and Marty got out and started to work some of the stone, and he found out that the red and the yellow petrified wood worked the best. And the black and the gray was really difficult to work. So he got out, you know, he napped it. That's what we call flint napping. He napped it with a K-N-A-P-P-Y. Anyway, so that we made that distinction eventually, fairly early on. So we knew when we got into the areas where the really colorful wood was, there are going to be a lot of quarries. And some of those quarries were huge. They'd be,
gosh,
you know, 400 by 800 meters long. And we would, you know, it was really difficult to work through that stuff, but it was interesting. Anyway, so we would start early in the morning, and we'd work until the monsoon chased us out of the field.
Okay.
Jeff Burton became the third guy to be our boss. And Jeff was a great archaeologist, and he still is, although now he's fighting cancer. Mm. But anyway, he was about almost 6'5". He was 6'4". And I'm 6'1". And the park is mostly grasslands.
Okay.
So we would get out there in those grasslands and just start walking transects. And then in the afternoon when the monsoon comes and we get into those lightning storms, lightning hits the highest object, and that would be Jeff and I.
Oh, my God.
So we actually, on occasion, would lay down in the grass and just lay there and let the rain just pelt us until the storm moved over.
Wow.
Which was pretty exciting. Yeah. One time, we're a couple of hundred meters in from the boundary fence, and we're laying there in the grass, and the rain is pelting, and the thunder and lightning is going. And all of a sudden, I get that peeler motor response, where all the hair in my body stands up.
Right.
And I go, what is that all about? And then I happened to be in a position, I was laying on my side, I could see the fence at a distance. And all of a sudden, this blue flash comes down the fence, and lightning hit the fence and was bouncing down the barbed wire fence on the boundary.
Wow.
And I had never seen anything like that. Huh. And, you know, all the hair in my body is standing at attention.
Yeah.
And I'm going, I'm trying to burrow further into the ground. And that was absolutely freaking terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why we started early in the morning, because sometimes in the afternoon we didn't want to be out there.
Right. Okay. So on the survey, you might find lithic scatters or habitation sites.
And we find structures. We find ceramics.
Okay.
Ceramics.
Yep. Yep.
Ceramics is the name of the game. So what we did is we collected what we called diagnostics. In other words, ceramics has usually been found in some setting where you can date something else. Like if you've got, you know, roof beams in the structure, you can do dendrochronology, retrieving data on that.
Right.
And there's a variety of other things they can use nowadays, archaeomagnetic dating and so on and so forth. So we have sites in the park that have been dated, but usually it's by the ceramics that have been found in a context where you can date it.
Okay.
So that was the thing that was really important. So we would collect just diagnostic items off the sites. So we might take, you know, 5 or 10 sherds. We would take diagnostic projectile points. In fact, the year just before we got there and started, somebody had found a Folsom Point in the park.
Oh, wow.
And that's a big deal, because that's Paleolithic time. That's really old.
Right.
Goes back to like 12,000, 14,000 years.
Mm.
Anyway, so we collect that. And for me, eventually, the first year I stayed in the KOA in Holbrook, and then drove to the park every day to work.
Okay.
After that first year, since they had to figure it out that I had all the experience from California, they hired me. And so I got to stay in the park then. They have limited housing in the park for staff, permanent staff that live there.
Okay.
And then they have set aside some housing for researchers.
Okay.
And the guy that designed and supervised the building of those structures should be forced to live there. Because were absolutely the low bid on that project. And the plumbing was an adventure. You would flush the toilet, and then it would come up somewhere else.
Oh, my God.
Like another structure in the kitchen sink. Oh, my God. It was just terrible.
Wow.
They were attractive structures. They had actually planted lawns in between the buildings and that kind of stuff. And the funny thing was, we'd get up in the morning and we'd walk out on the sidewalk. We would find the tails of rabbits, cotton tails. And the coyotes were coming in at night and snagging the cotton tails and eating them.
Oh, wow.
And they'd eat the whole rabbit except the tail. I had no idea. I had never seen that one before. So we'd find all these little poofy, you know, cottontails laying out on the sidewalk, and the rabbits are long gone. And some coyote has gone home to his den very happy.
Wow.
So that was kind of an interesting phenomenon. The park has a variety of animals. Antelope is the principal one.
Okay.
They have two types of snakes. They have a Hopi rattler and what they call a prairie rattler. And the prairie rattlers, I can't say that, were somewhat smaller, and they had like two stripes toward their button, toward the rattle. The Hopi rattlers were about 3 feet tall, three feet long maybe, but not, they weren't like the rattlers we get here in California, which can be 6 feet long.
Mm.
So anyway, that was a hazard we had to watch. But you know, it gets really hot there. So the only time you see the rattlers are on your first transects earlier in the morning.
Okay.
The one thing that astounded me, one of the early years we were out there, we ran into a porcupine.
Oh wow!
What in heaven's name was a porcupine doing in the petrified forest?
No kidding. I mean, this is grassland. As you said, there's not a single tree.
Yes, it's grasslands. And there are a few scattered pinyon pine or junipers, mainly junipers,
okay,
here and there. But there's no concentration of them. There's no, you know, it's nothing you would call a woodland. So anyway, so there were a few animals around. And of course, all kinds of raptors and the usual stuff that you'd see. But that porcupine flummoxed me.
Wow.
And it was the only one we ever saw, and I don't know how it actually got out there. It must have been lost. Anyway.
Hey, Don, can you
speak
a little bit about Ann Trinkle Jones from Virginia? What do you remember
very
about her?
Ann was Trinkle, everybody called her Trinkle. Trinkle was really, really bright, and she had the Virginia accent is very different from what I'm used to.
Okay.
We got some hardcore people from Oklahoma and stuff that I went to school with. So I was used to a more y'all type of accent. Good leader, attractive woman. Supervised the project after the first couple of years. She actually went out in the field and walked transects with us beginning.
Okay.
And then conducted the orientation and all that kind of stuff. But then eventually just, you know, supervised it from afar because she had other administrative duties. She went up the ladder with promotions and stuff with the Park Service. So she was great. And all the people that we worked with from the Park Service were super duper. They were very patient with us. I'd have to mention one project we were on. We got a gal, and she will go unnamed. And she was an absolute pill. She must have been going through some personal problems. You know, we'd come into the park after working, and we would fix our meals. And we had a kitchen we could fix our meals in. And then we would sit down at a table, and we'd go through the bags of diagnostics that we had collected. And of course, we had them in bags, and they were labeled, you know, so we could figure out the provenience. Provenience is everything, you know.
Right.
Where did it come from? So that was a great learning session for me, because I would go, okay, you know, why is this what it is?
Hmm.
And we had pottery going back to Basket Maker. It was a brownware called Adamana Brown and Woodruff Brown. And those things were Basket Maker in age. In fact, they were the first pottery in that region. That was the first pottery chronologically in that region.
Wow.
And then we had stuff coming up all the way. In later days, the stuff got really nice. In fact, toward the end, we were getting stuff from Zuni being traded in. And we got glazewares, which were a whole different ballgame to me, and polychromes. And, boy, we got some beautiful ceramics.
And
that we
in
found.
The what's the name of the Homolivi? The
Homolivi, yeah.
That kind of pottery.
Homolivi was just down the road, and there are four different sites at Homolivi.
Okay.
And I went there several times, and because there was a gal who was really good with rock art named Sally Cole, C-O-L-E, and Sally eventually published extensively on rock art. So I went down and ran into her, and she kept track of what I was finding, and I kept track of what she. So we corresponded quite a bit,
okay.
Which was useful because she had a lot of experience and wrote extensively later on.
You mentioned the Zuni pottery and the glazeware in Petrified, and of course the only thing I can think of nearby because I haven't seen the stuff in Petrified is a Homolivi, very lightweight, very thin pottery, incredibly designed. Was that in Petrified as well?
Yes, we did. We got the stuff from come on, Don. I keep blanking out here. Jedito. We got the Jedito wares, which are yellow wares.
Okay.
And those are Hopi. They go all the way into the historic period.
Okay.
But they start probably about Pueblo III period of time, like, let's say, 1250, 1200 A.D.,
okay.
So we got those. Those were very distinctive because they're a pale yellow, and the designs were painted in black. Right. And I got a chance to go out to the big site for yellowware 1 year. I went out to Jedito.
Okay.
And the interesting thing there is there was a gigantic ruin that the prehistoric folks built. And then when the Spanish came in, Spanish were so brutal.
Yeah.
They attacked these guys and killed a whole bunch of folks and so forth. And then eventually the Indians struck back, and they did the old knotted twine routine where they took a piece of fiber and tied knots in it. And then they sent people out as messengers, and every day they untied one of the knots in the twine. And when they had untied all of them, that was the single that the Pueblo people all through New Mexico and Arizona rose up and wiped out the Spanish.
And that was the Pueblo Revolt.
The Pueblo Revolt.
16.
Yeah, 14.
When was
15,
that?
14. Oh, boy. I've just blanked on the dates.
Okay.
14 or 1500s.
Okay.
But then eventually the Spanish came back in and,
right,
made them pay the price for it.
Right.
So anyway, we got the Hopi ware.
Okay.
We got stuff from the mountains to the south. We got stuff that probably was related to Chaco Canyon. We got some ceramics that were Chaco in design. That doesn't mean people from Chaco are coming, but the ceramics showed up.
Right.
So ceramics are really important because you can trace movements of groups.
Okay.
So anyway.
Okay. Any other stories about Trinkle before we leave her?
No, I don't think so. It'll come to me as we go, probably.
Okay. All right. Okay. So Jack and Pat have worked with the superintendent of Petrified to get this thing going, and they're actually going to kick in some money to pay people to work on this.
Yeah, we didn't. They paid the Park Service guys because they were taken away from their normal routine of their normal jobs, so they compensated them for that, and then they paid. I think I was the only so-called volunteer that got paid. because I was the only volunteer that came in that had an extensive background in archaeology, although it wasn't Southwestern archaeology. It was California.
How many months or weeks a summer would you be out there?
It would vary from 2 weeks up to, I think the most I worked was 6 weeks.
Okay.
Which was about as long as my wife had permit me to be over there.
Okay.
There's always things to do at home, like put on a new roof or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Okay. And you've got 90-some miles, 92 miles of land to cover twice. So that's 180, 184 miles. No, you're doing
four times.
Four times.
We have to walk that four times to get 100 meters.
Now we're talking close to 400 miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of miles.
Okay.
But I was used to that, you know. The Mojave Desert's a big place, too, and you walk everywhere.
Okay.
So that was okay. That didn't bother me.
Nice.
We found some very interesting things that showed up. We had fragments of seashell. God, why can't I remember these things this morning? Anyway, that comes out of the Gulf of California.
Okay.
And so those would show up occasionally. They were basically as bracelets and maybe pendants. We found a quartz crystal on a couple of occasions in all that world of sandstone.
Wow.
Quartz crystals.
Huh.
We found on one site we actually found a granite handstone. There's
wow.
no granite out there. I don't know where that came from.
Somebody carried it in.
Yeah, we have a term in archaeology for it. It's called a manuport.
Okay.
A manuport is an object that doesn't belong there that shows up. So we had strange things like that.
Where do you think that granite would have come from? Would that from the Mogollon Rim somewhere, or where's the nearest granite?
Yes, it'd have to be. That would be my best guess.
Okay.
We'd get ceramics that came out of the south, out of the mountains to the south.
Okay.
Anyway, so it was interesting the things that we were finding and so forth. I definitely remember one shell that we found was a half of a bivalve, or a half of bivalve, that had incised a frog on the top of the shell.
Wow.
And I was stunned. But then later on, I saw somewhere in a book that somebody had found a shell in which they actually had used the acid from cactus to eat into the shell. And then they had to take small fragments of turquoise and inserted them, which was just beyond my ability. We found, think it was slate that was the size of a belt buckle that you would win at a rodeo.
Okay.
And we call it the belt buckle. It was oval shaped. And it was incised in a geometric design. It was like four. It was divided into quarters, and then each quarter had the same geometric design on it. And that was an interesting piece of work. We never saw another thing like that. That was a very interesting thing.
Oh.
So there were odd things like that.
Where do you think the slate came from? That's like really
far away. I can't remember seeing another piece of slate the whole time I was over there.
Huh.
That was a one of kind. So we would find a very unusual things like that.
Okay.
We even found some unusual historic stuff. There were places they obviously ran sheep in that area, and there were places where we'd run into Hispanic inscriptions on rocks.
Okay.
From sheep herders.
Yeah.
One time we even found a hand pair of sheep shears.
A complete
hand pair of sheep shears. They were rusted, but they were laying out there in the sand.
Wow.
We did collect that. So we found some a wide variety of things, but it was ceramics was the name of the game. That was an interesting thing.
So the material that you're finding and you're collecting, you're obviously keeping. This is a location number, and this is what we found.
Oh, yes.
Was that material stored in WAC down in Tucson, or was it stored? It was okay.
It's all going to WAC.
Okay.
The park didn't have any facility for curating any artifacts.
Got it.
So they didn't have a museum. Well, they have a museum down in the painted something. They have one down at the end of the park, the south end.
Okay.
But it only had a few items in it.
Okay.
One of the problems we discovered is because there is petrified wood in there.
Right.
People do come in to steal it. Well, at the south end of the park, just outside the park boundary, is an outfit called the Patton Brothers, P-A-T-T-O-N. They had a curio shop, and they sold groceries and stuff like that. But basically, they sold petrified wood. Okay. That was collected off outside the park that people could buy and various things. Well, they got out and found some private landholders that would sell them entire petrified logs.
Okay.
And some of those logs are up to like, you know, 18, 20 feet long.
Wow.
And they sold some complete petrified logs. We just see them going out on flatbed trucks, usually to collectors in Japan.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't have any idea why the Japanese were so keen on that.
Huh.
And at one memorable occasion, we were walking along, you know, surveying inside the fence line, and we saw underneath, adjacent to the fence, running into the park and then outside of the park, this big furrow where somebody had drug something really heavy through the sand.
Oh, my gosh.
And somebody had snaked a petrified log in the park close to the boundary and drug it outside, got it outside, and then got it on a truck and sold it out to Japan, I presume.
Wow.
Anyway, so that was an interesting thing. There are law enforcement people in the park, NPS guys, and they were still talking about the fact that they had made a big-time bust on a bunch of pot hunters. And what they had done, just on the south end of the park, we hadn't surveyed down there yet, they had put metal detectors. And the metal detectors would detect, you know, anything that was a high percentage of metal. And they had some pot hunters come in, got over the fence, which wasn't, you know, the fence is a normal barbed wire fence height.
Right.
It's not big. They had climbed across the fence with shovels, and they had set off the metal detectors. So all the law enforcement guys in the park jumped in their vehicles, drove like maniacs down, and they caught these guys with their shovels and screens.
Oh, gosh.
Preparing to inside the park boundary, and they busted them. And they went off to jail. And I'm sure they were convicted. So that was a big, and all those guys, so that was the most exciting thing that ever happened to them. The law enforcement guys bugged me. I thought, you know what, if you really want to be a law enforcement guy, Los Angeles Police Department is hiring people all the time. So why don't you go to California and go to LAPD, because they could use you. And of course, they just showed up on the television yesterday, posting, you know, anti-war protesters. So and Trump even called in the National Guard to help them.
Right. You're in California. That's right.
That was a non-entity. There was no need for the National Guard. And, of course, the governor is furious. Everybody in California is furious.
Mm.
Trump is sticking his nose into our business and creating an incident where there wasn't an incident. It was a handful of people, and they brought in, you know, 2,000 National Guardsmen.
All right, let's leave current events off for a minute here.
Let's get back to the business.
But the law enforcement, at least they were able to you know, put out some metal detectors so that when people came in, they could alert them to that to protect park resources. So that's good. But yeah, you're right. The crime at petrified, I'm assuming, I could be wrong, is fairly low level. It's tourists.
And it's
putting
piddly diddly. It's usually people picking up four or five pieces of petrified wood and trying to sneak out of the park.
And then trying to throw them through their car windows on their way out.
Well, one time we were working on the south end. We were doing an excavation, which I'll get to, on the south end. And I had my head down and digging, But one of the people said, "Hey, look, there's some people out there walking around." And then they stop. And they appear to be bending over, and then they get upright again, and they move on. And I look down, and I go, "Oh, God, there's people inside the park boundary. There's three of them, and they're collecting.
Wow.
So I go, "We don't. Usually, we had a sound power telephone. The phones that you can use,
like a sat phone.
We had a sat phone.
Not a park radio."
We did have park radios, but they usually were too far away from the thing for them to work. We had a sat radio now and then. Anyway, and I was with a group that didn't have the sat radio. We only had one.
Okay.
And so I go, "Boy, you know, those people are collecting. I better go down and stop them." So I marched off the point, and it was about a half mile away. And I hiked down there, and I said, "Hey, folks, what are y'all doing?" And they go, "We're just hiking." I go, "I think you're collecting petrified wood." And they go, "Oh, no. And one guy was really vociferous. Well, he wound up, he was a lawyer. And he became the spokesman. And he gave me a lot of lip. And he and I got into a hot dispute. And I was about ready to bust him in the mouth. And I got, "You know, if I do that, it's going to be a big incident. The park's going to be unhappy with me. So I'm just going to have to swallow my mouth and not get in a fight with this guy." But I was really tempted. I showed a great deal of restraint, because usually when I was grew up, we had any disputes, we immediately went to fisticuffs.
Okay.
And I had more than my share of fights as a young man growing up. So this was tough for me to keep my mouth shut. So I had to let him go. So anyway, we did get back, and they got on the radio, and they were able to get through, and they said, "Look, we've got people that we saw collecting, and they're parked along the fence just above Patton's, and by God, they got the police down there, and they caught them on a state highway as they were driving away."
All right.
And they did bust them, and they opened up, they looked in the vehicle, and they had all kinds of petrified wood and stuff stuck away.
Okay.
So we did catch those ones. That was good. I was pleased with that.
Good. I wanted to ask you about Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N,
yes.
And I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time to ask you about Carl or not. And if it's not, let's hold that.
He was an administrator, and I'm not sure what he was in charge of initially. He shows up, however, and I will come back to Carl, because he's the guy that brought some Hopi advisors out to us on a very important event.
Okay.
And so he will provide transportation for two Hopi elders from Shongapovi to come and visit us.
Wow. Okay.
And I'll come to that.
Okay.
Because that was a big deal. Carl's also the guy Carl's the guy that had quite a collection of rugs. He liked to go to Crown Point for the rug auctions.
Yep.
And somehow he and I made a connection in the park after hours talking. And he said, "I've just been to Crown Point and I bought some stuff, and my wife is a little upset because I bought too many things." He says, and I said, "Well, you know, I have a modest collection of Indian art that my wife collected at home." And so I bought a Ganado red rug from Carl, and I paid the outrageous sum for me, not for Carl, of $250 for him.
Wow.
And I'm sitting in my front room looking at that rug right now.
Nice.
And it's a beautiful rug. The problem with it is that it's an aniline dye. That's a commercial dye. And if it's exposed to the light, it fades.
Okay.
So in the afternoon, the sun hits just a little bit of the bottom, and so it's a little bit faded in the bottom edge. But I mounted the rug with two pieces of board at the top and then hung it. I put the rough side out. There's always on a rug a rough side and a smooth side. So I put the rough side out. The backside is absolutely gorgeous. It's
nice.
Vivid red, and it's beautiful rug.
Wow.
In fact, I have a Technos Posh rug, which is natural dyes, in the bathroom. And that faded. And I'm going, how can that be? The bathroom, there's no direct light in it. Well, I have, God, what a dummy. I have a skylight in the bathroom.
Oh my gosh.
Skylight in both the bathrooms.
Yeah.
And just the light from the skylight, I was sitting in there meditating. I looked up and I said, my God, the sun comes at one time of the day, comes
yep.
directly down through that skylight.
Yeah.
And the whole bottom of my natural dyed rug is faded.
Uh-huh.
And you flip it over on the back side, the smooth side, and it's good shape. It's a nice Technos Posh. But anyway, I transgress.
Okay.
So the first year we got through, we had wonderful cooperation from the Park Service. It didn't take long for the volunteers to get into the groove and know what we were looking for. But we ran into some things that were strange. We kept finding these things we called donut holes. And they were slabs of sandstone that had, they were maybe 3 feet by 4 feet, something like that. Maybe not that big, two by 3 feet. And they had a hole pecked through the middle. And the hole was maybe 12 inches, 16 inches wide in diameter.
That's pretty big.
And they were weird, and we couldn't figure out what they were for. And then we actually found one that was upright in the sand. It was sticking up above the ground. I go, Jesus, what are these things? And eventually we will find out when we get to the excavations. Maybe I just better hit that right now.
Yeah.
What the donut stones were, they were actually covers for subterranean cysts.
Oh, okay.
Storage pits. And so what they did is they would dig a hole in the ground. Usually it was wider at the bottom than it was at the top. And then they would store things in there, like corn. And so they put these slabs over the top with a hole in it. And then they would take another sandstone slab and put it over the hole.
Right. Okay.
So when they wanted to store something in there, they would just move the stone, the covering slab to the side, and then they could drop it into the hole. And by having a slab with a hole in it on the top, you minimize the amount of sand that would drop into the hole when you wanted to put corn in there and store.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense.
So that was pretty interesting, and we finally deciphered what that was all about.
Nice.
Okay. We ran into a site on the survey close to the boundary fence, and then eventually we found out it was outside the boundary fence.
Ooh.
They didn't have it wasn't fenced entirely in some areas. They hadn't got around to that yet because it was difficult for them to get materials out there. Barbed wire rolls, metal stakes,
mm-hmm.
and so
mm-hmm.
forth,
right?
So it wasn't complete. So we ran into the site that eventually became known as Site 236. And we walked up on that site and we go, holy cow, there's this big elliptical circle that's got a sandstone rim to it and a cavity in it. And then there's a big pile of rubble off to the side.
I mean, it kind of sounds like a ball court.
Yeah, except they don't have ball. Well, they do have ball courts in that area. We got into ball courts when I got a little further north.
Okay,
outside the park.
Shot that out. I thought, it sounds like a but I don't know. So keep going.
We didn't either. So we ran into this elliptical feature, and there's this pile of rubble, and the pile of rubble looked like a house because there was a lot of sandstone slab in it.
Okay.
And so that intrigued everybody. Well, especially intrigued Pat and Jack McCreary. So what they did, bless their hearts, we found out that this site, 236, was outside the boundary fence.
Okay.
We go, oh, what a shame. Well, they went to the Archaeological Conservancy, and they found out that the person that owned that, this had been subdivided back in the years ago. Hmm. And somebody back east had bought this parcel. I'm not sure how big the parcel was. And they had never done anything with it. They never even had visited it. They had never been out there.
Okay.
McCreary's bought it.
Oh, wow.
They bought this parcel of land. Maybe about 800 meters by 800 meters. I'm not sure how big it was.
Okay.
Anyway, and then there was a hassle about they wanted to give it to the Park Service, and they had to go through this elaborate red tape thing to get, and they gave it to the Park Service. Park Service got title to it.
Great.
So years later, we actually went out and excavated that because everybody in the world wanted to know what Site 236 was.
Mm.
And so we got a group of folks together. Oh, we got out there and we went out. And of course, initially we did some test pits to figure out what we want.
Okay.
In fact, one of them was they were going to dig a 1 meter wide trench just outside where all these features were. And so they got it outlined. They got their string in there. They started to clear it off. And they got about 20 meters into the trench, and they found human remains.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was the end of the trench. We immediately backfilled it and didn't dig any further. Anyway, so we started messing around, and this big circle thing really bugged us. So I dug a 1 meter wide trench across the circle from one side to the other. And at the two ends of the circle, I ran into sandstone, substantial pieces of sandstone.
Okay.
And I cleared them away, and what they were a bench,
huh.
A sandstone bench. And so we exposed a good portion of it, not the whole thing, but we took just a shovel and shovel scraped the top to make sure that it was really intact, and it was. It was entirely enclosed, but we didn't dig down to the bench. So we found this feature with a bench. We presume that it was a great kiva.
Okay.
And I dug the trench across, and we hit nothing in the middle. There were no other features like a floor drum or any other items that might give us a clue. We brought both the Hopi and the Zuni out to look at it and get their input, and that was kind of interesting. The Zuni came out and go, oh gosh, don't expose any more of it. Leave it intact. Just don't mess with it.
Hmm.
And the Hopi came out and they go, dig the dadgum thing up and let's see what it is. And they had entirely different interpretations on how we should handle it. So we did expose about half the bench and made sure that it did go completely around.
Hmm.
But they went down as a great kiva. There are some great kivas that are not roofed. If you've been to Aztec, you know that a very famous archaeologist excavated that and then rebuilt the whole thing.
Okay.
In fact, even in Aztec, they even have piped in music. Indian flute music or something, and it's absolutely crazy, but it's very interesting. So anyway, we had what was a great kiva, and then we got into messing around with the mound of rubble, and that wound up being what we call a great house.
Okay,
and it was probably two stories tall, and we only excavated a portion of it. We did we outlined the wall, we shovel scraped the walls. For about half of it, and then I did excavate one room in it, and the masonry looked a lot like Chaco. It was nice work. It was really excellent masonry. Now, I'm not saying it's a Chaco site, but it sure has some similarities to what you see in Chaco, because Chaco is famous for its masonry.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was interesting. And so that wound up being something that we eventually did over the course of working there for those years. Okay, let's see. The rock art was interesting. We had lots of petroglyphs. There were only, I think, three sites in the entire park that had pictographs in them.
Okay.
And they were in little dinky rock shelters.
Right.
But most of it was petroglyphs.
Which makes sense because it's the landscape, rolling hills with outcrops
right.
of sandstone. You don't. It's yeah, not like you
yeah,
have
yeah,
any
yeah,
kind
it's just
of
outcrops. Yeah,
of,
it's very difficult
of, different of overhangs terrain. To shelter under.
Yeah. So anyway, Carl Bowman was the park resource officer during this time.
Okay.
So he was a guy that we did check in with frequently. He didn't come out in the field that much because he was an administrative man. He had other things to do.
Okay, so the resources officer.
Okay, yeah. And we'll come back to him because he's going to play a key role here. And we did make contact with some of the people that lived around the perimeter of the park.
Okay.
And one guy that really became a really big supporter of us, and I think he was on a park advisory commission or committee or something.
Huh.
Anyway, there's a guy named Bill Jeffords, Jeffords, who owned a ranch to the north and of the park,
okay.
north and east of the park. And somehow, I don't know, I think Jack McGurry made contact with him. I think they were having a beer together or something. Anyway, the gals would sometimes on the weekends got to do laundry because we're out there for long periods of time.
Hmm.
They have a washer and dryer in the park that the researchers could use.
Okay.
So usually I'd get up early. I always get up early. I have this bad habit.
Okay.
I'd get up early, you know, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock on a Sunday and go in and do my laundry because there'd be nobody in there. Nobody in their right mind gets up at 5 o'clock
yeah.
in the morning to do
yeah.
laundry.
Exactly.
I'm a little different. So we made contact with Bill Jeffords. He invited us out to his ranch and then drove us around in his truck while we looked at his property. And he had some amazing petroglyph sites on his
oh, wow.
on his property. And so he said, you know, you guys are welcome to come in. We'll arrange a time for you to come in. I'll drive you out there and show you. You can drive your vehicles too. Just follow me and we'll go out and I'll show you the sites.
Hmm.
And he did. And one day we're out there, and here comes his wife in another truck, and she brought us a picnic lunch.
Oh, wow.
That we ate out in the field. What a nice lady. I mean, fried chicken, potato salad, iced tea. I mean, and she didn't have to do that, but
mm-hmm.
they were just that kind of people. They were great folks.
Nice.
So that was really nice.
Huh.
We really appreciated that. Jeffers was, I think he still owns that property.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Mm.
All right. So the years go by. We get a changing cast of characters. Almost every day we'd have new volunteers that I didn't know who they were. They were just park employees.
Okay.
But the park people are out there looking around. And one of the interesting discoveries they made, one of the guys in the park and his son were out hiking, and they got caught in an afternoon rainstorm, which
okay.
that's pretty common.
Yeah.
And they found a little tiny crevice in the sandstone, and they squoze themselves into it, and it was like a little tiny rock shelter.
Okay.
And they got in there, and they sat down, and they waited out the storm. And while they're sitting there, his son goes, well, Dad, what's that up on that shelf of sandstone? And they looked up, and they had found an intact basket.
Oh, wow.
And everybody, that just blew everybody's mind. Now, the crazy thing is, we had actually recorded that, because on the face of the rock outside, there's a spiral and a few other minor petroglyphs. So we had recorded it. And Marty Kagan actually exposed it into that rock shelter and looked around and
no.
didn't see anything.
Oh, no. Huh.
Because he came in, you know, he came in out of bright sunlight and
right.
it was a little tiny rock shelter, which was dark. And he gave it a cursory glance and he missed the basket.
Yeah.
Boy, did we, you know, I egg him on about that one later. Anyway.
Sure.
So this guy told some of us on the thing about, you know, my kid found a basket out there. We go, really? So we went out, and Trinkle Jones came just for this occasion when we collected the basket. So we got in there, and we collected the basket, and it wound up being Navajo.
Wow.
It's a coil basket. I don't know how big it is. 2.5 feet high by maybe 1.5 feet wide.
Okay.
It's a poorly done, but it's a quickie job. It was something they did and didn't spend a lot of time on, but the rodents hadn't got to it neat, and so it was intact.
Oh, that's amazing.
So we went out and we collected that, and that's in the WAC headquarters now in Tucson.
Okay.
And that was amazing. So we had Trinkle go out there, and we had somebody snagged the basket out, brought it out, pushed it up through the hole. And Trinkle, I got a picture of Trinkle holding that basket with a gigantic smile on her.
That's
because
right.
the possibility of recovering an intact basket is slim and none.
Absolutely.
Here in the Mojave, occasionally I'll find a site with basket fragments in it, but never complete ones.
Right.
I got hooked on hiking and backpacking into a Grand Gulch and Cedar Mesa. And I would find fragments of basketry there, but never a complete basket. So anyway, that was a big deal. That was pretty exciting. Okay, moving on. There was one rock art panel in particular that caught everybody's eye. And the reason being, it had, I should just walk in the other room and look at it and describe it. It'd be easier to. Hang on just a sec.
Okay.
Get up. Okay, I'm up. I'm going to move to the other room. I have vertigo.
Yes.
Full-time, nonstop. And I am extremely unstable, and I fall down a lot.
Mm.
And that's just life in the big city. So it takes me a little while to get around because I have to use a walking stick or I have to use a walker.
Okay, good.
Which just galls me to death because I used to run about 30 miles a week, and now I can hardly walk to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Okay, the reason I can give you a blow by blow, a guy named Ron Beckworth worked with us at the park, and Ron, come on, boys, Ron is a good artist.
Okay,
and so he did a poster of this, which he sold commercially.
Huh.
Of this rock art panel because it's so exceptional.
Nice.
It's got several anthropomorphs on it, people. Three of them are obviously women,
right?
Because they're wearing the butterfly hairdo, which women before they're married wear in the Hopi tribes. And two of the women are holding what they call timpanis. Come on, boys. Time out. I'm going to make a noise here.
Okay.
Okay. Two of the women are holding what we call prayer sticks.
Okay.
And another one is holding, I'm not sure what it is. And then there's some gals that are holding what we call, for lack of a better term, water rattles. And I don't know if they're really water rattles or not, but that's what somebody from some ethnography disguise proposed that they probably were.
Okay.
So there's all these figures on it with ceremonial objects.
Wow.
And gals with the Hopi hairdo.
Lovely.
The maiden hairdo.
Okay.
So Ron made a poster out of it and sold it.
Hmm.
And he gave me one since I'm the guy that found the panel.
Nice.
Which is only fair.
Yeah. Huh.
He didn't cut me in for any of the profits, and
no.
I didn't want him.
Huh. That's pretty neat.
Okay, I'm mobile again. I'm not used to talking.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes I get raspy.
Totally understood. It's a practice.
My cat is not much of a conversationalist.
Understood.
Yeah, you're looking at me. You're just eating some food out of your food dish. I've had dogs all my life because we hunted, and so I've gone through a whole bunch of Springer Spaniels.
Mm.
And dogs, you know, when you feed them, they eat everything in the bowl. Cats graze. You know, that cat just eats a bit here, a bit there. And like food is not a big deal with him.
Right, right. Way more selective.
Yeah.
And that, that project at Petrified started in 84-ish and ran...
85.
Okay. And ran... And you were doing...
19. It's going to run all the way to 1985 to 1995.
Okay, for 10 years.
11 years. Because
That's right. So during that 11-year period, you were summers at Petrified, and but only 2 weeks to 6 weeks. Were you doing other summer field work? As you mentioned, you do have a wife that says, "Well, hey, look, you know, the grass doesn't need to be cut there outside."
Because here the only other place I was doing work was the Mojave Desert.
Okay.
And you can't go out there because it's triple temperatures.
Too hot.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I do the Mojave stuff in the winter.
Okay. I'm wondering, maybe we would want to talk about this same time period in your Mojave work next time. But I'm not sure that we finished yet with Petrified.
No, we haven't.
Okay. So maybe I'm looking at the time here, and we've been going a good over an hour. Maybe this is a time to put a comma in this interview series, and next time we'll pick up Petrified again.
Okay. And when we come back, so you have a reference point, we're going to do two excavations there.
Okay.
So we got some excavations which we're going to do.
All right.
Other than just, you know, the stuff we did at Site 236.
Okay, I'll make a note of that.
Yeah.
Good. And then...
So then I'll know where to start, too.
Exactly. All right. Very good. So with that, let's conclude part 4 of a Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Don Christensen. Today is Monday. It's June 9th, 2025. My name is Tom Martin, and Don, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.